sitting quietly for a couple of minutes before the Dharma talk. Welcome to the Dharma talk. The title this afternoon is Freedom of the Heart. And its subtitle is a quotation from the Buddha. And the phrase that he used was, a heart everywhere let go. It's a line from a poem that we're going to look at and endeavor to understand. So I invite you to sit with a heart everywhere let go. So with a heart that's at least receptive to letting go of everything and letting go everywhere. The Buddha's poem goes like this. Gone to the beyond of becoming, you let go of in front, you let go of behind, let go of between, with a heart everywhere let go, you don't come again to birth and aging. I'll read it again, and then I'll try or endeavor to explain it. Gone to the beyond of becoming, you let go of in front, let go of behind, let go in between, with a heart everywhere let go. You don't come again to birth and aging. So we heard last night in one of the inquiries about a freedom that can come when we give up wanting to become somebody or something. And when becoming ends, there's just the simplicity of doing without being caught up in the me who's doing it, without making an additional construction of somebody who's standing behind all of our experiences. But rather, there's just the simplicity of the activity, the event, the doing. The Buddha taught that there is nothing that is a self or belongs to a self. We've had lots of questions about this today, and hopefully by the end of the talk it will be a little more clear. So when we see from a standpoint of me, I, me and my, We're limited and we're bound. And there's no real freedom in that. We're caught in time. We're caught in the limitation of this body, which will, rather naturally, come to an end. So, of course, the sense of I can land on the body. And over, we three teachers have been suggesting that we don't fix upon this idea of I and the body, but rather we see the body as not self. We see all forms as not self. Because we wouldn't, the Buddha once said, see that pile of leaves over there the monks are sweeping up? Is that you? And the monk he was talking to said, well, of course not. So he said, in the same way, this body is not self. Those leaves are not self. Our feelings, which shift and change, just like the weather, as Muli so beautifully described this morning, our feelings are totally unreliable too. So we see that our feelings are not self. Our perceptions, the way we perceive the world, is coloured by our memory from the past. What we mean by perception is, if I open my eyes right here in the room, just like that, I know I'm at Endor and I know I'm sitting up here teaching, and there's a whole lot of perceived ideas that instantly are here. The mind is so fast. And this is perception. And our perceptions are sometimes accurate and sometimes inaccurate. So sometimes the I thought lands in the world of perception and clings. It's only problematic if there's clinging. The I thought can also land in the mental formations and constructions, what we think, our ideas, our views, opinions, our judgments. This is the I thought landing in what's called the mental formations. And the sense of me can grip there, or we can just see it as a thought. Not me, not mine, not who I am. This is a teaching. And the same with consciousness. The conscious of sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, and thought. And if we get caught up and we say, oh, I am aware of this extraordinary cosmos, and we can, you know, elevate consciousness, expand consciousness, and if we cling to that, we'll think we're some heavenly creature walking the earth. So it really is a matter of seeing it. And the Buddha said that all of these things are not ours. And the sutta goes, what is it that's not yours? Form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, not yours. And then he says, abandon what is not yours, and you'll be happy for a very long time. So the Buddha is famous for this particular teaching. Nobody else, none of the other religions teach in this way, none of the other teachers other than the Buddha and those who follow the Buddha teach with this method of seeing not self. Now, just to be very clear, we are not trying to get rid of the self or delete it or negate it or cancel it out, as somebody asked today, more than one person asked today. Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of the great teachers of Thailand, one of Christopher Titmus's teachers, and also one of my teachers, said, self is not self already. We don't have to change it. We don't have to do anything about it. It's already not self. We just have to let go of the belief in a thing or a person that's me, and simply see the shifting, changing nature of sensation, of feelings, of thoughts, and of all that makes up our experience in this world. So, can we just sit here with the heart everywhere let go? Why not? Just try it. It's to sit. What it means, a heart everywhere let go, means to sit with a heart that doesn't cling or grasp anywhere. So our heart has the capacity to embrace the totality of our existence. Everything. Everything. Our joy, our sorrow, our pain, our rage, our despair, our exquisite happiness. That's what we mean when we say heart. And we're invited to see or be with our experience in a particular way. And that way is the path of freedom. That way is the path of the heart. That way is the path of liberation. And the key is non-clinging, non-grasping. The Pali word, citta, is a word that's used to describe all that we experience, and it means heart and mind. All. There's no adequate translation of the word citta. We tend to think that mind is up here somewhere and heart is down here. In Asia, it's quite different. The expression is, the understanding is non-dual. Heart and mind go together. So please, if mind works for you, say mind. If heart works for you, say heart. Or sometimes you'll find me saying heart-mind, just to cover all bases. So please understand, when we say sitting with a heart of non-clinging, we mean heart-mind, the totality. So initially in our practice, we bring our attention to all that occurs with a sensitivity. And the natural heart has a radiance, a luminosity. So our awareness is like a light, it shines. And so that's what we do, we shine the light on our suffering, on our sorrows, on all of our pain, on our anguish, our despair. And of course, on the joys, the lightness, the fun, the laughter as well. So the light of wisdom shines on the pleasant and the unpleasant, and the in-between, as we heard this morning. It shines on the painful, and also on that which is delightfully exquisite. And so our practice is to be rather steady in the face of all of that. So not to cling to the fineness of our experience. Not to cling to the pleasant experiences and avoid the unpleasant. Because otherwise, if we don't do that, if we do cling, what happens is we're caught in the tide of our likes and dislikes. And consciousness is thrown about by our desires or compulsions and obsessions or habitual patterns from the past. And there isn't any freedom in that. So we have to see and understand what it is to be awake, but alive, intelligently, wakefully. We really have to get to know ourselves. So when we look, when we start to meditate on our feeling and our emotional world, we can ask ourselves, well, what's the condition of my heart and mind today? And sometimes the condition is one of greed. We'll notice that we're rushing after things. Or in blind pursuit of something. We want somebody or something or an object we want to acquire. Or we may see that that is actually absent. Greed is absent from the mind today. So we just check that out. We go, oh, what's present and what's absent today? Ah, I'm feeling greedy, okay? I can either be compelled by that, or I can just see it as is and stop. The mind of greed wants to bring things to oneself, to appropriate, to possess, to have. Another one of the great dualities of mind is the mind of negativity or the mind of ill will, the mind that sees faults everywhere. And when we're caught up in that, what we see is we look around and we become rather critical and judgmental. Or, of course, we look inwardly and the inner critic goes wild, saying all kinds of things about ourselves, which nobody else would probably say to us. But here we are thinking that we're the most unworthy human being on the planet. I've not yet met the person who's unworthy. Yet this mental formation, this construction, this belief, colours the consciousness of so many of us. Or there's thoughts like, I'm unlovable, I'm inadequate, I'm not good enough. I don't have the right to exist. And these are very painful formations. They're very painful ways to live life, if we live according to that. So we have to look and see. Sometimes the heart-mind is rather deluded. That's when we need our friends, because we're so deluded we can't see it. To be deluded means we don't see clearly. And often our friends point out things and we go, no, 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 completely wrong. And then another friend and another friend says the same thing. And then we go, oh, whoops, maybe there's something I'm not seeing. This is delusion. This is confusion. So we have to know ourselves. And then we have to relate to others and listen not only inwardly to our own views about ourselves, but get a little feedback from others as well. So we check out, okay, is my mind clear today? Is it cloudy? Is it distracted? Is it focused? Is my mind burdened today? Is it unburdened? Do I feel free? Do I feel bound? So we just see it as is. We bring awareness to it. But rather than get caught up in what we see, the practice is one of resting in the awareness itself. So we rest in that which has the capacity to reveal without being caught up in the objects in this life, which include our thoughts and feelings and ideas and concepts, beliefs and ideas, without being caught up in all of that. This is what's meant by a heart everywhere let go. We see it, and that's not a problem. It's not a problem that it's actually there. We see it and rest in that awareness and are rather steady with all of the different dualities of mind, and therefore we don't have to be compelled by our habitual ways of doing things that we know have caused us harm or somebody else harm in the past. Our heart has the capacity to embrace everything with attention, and there are some teachings the Buddha gave about how to develop and cultivate the attention. And I'll just briefly, hopefully, go through them. The first one is called in Pali Vitika, and it means to have a thought that can direct our attention. Now, I know that some of you think that all thoughts are terrible and that meditation is getting rid of our thoughts. That is not correct, please. That is just an idea, a misunderstanding, actually. So, we can have a thought that reminds us to direct our attention to that which frees us. So an example of this would be, I'm sitting here meditating, I drift off, and then the thought is, oh, come back to the breath. Or I'm sitting here and I notice my posture is slumped over and I think, oh, straighten up the body. Or I'm eating and I think, oh, eat more mindfully, eat more slowly, be present. So these are thoughts that have the capacity to direct attention in a rather helpful way. And of course, there are some thoughts that lead to a loosening up or a freeing of consciousness and our life, and there's some thoughts that lead to misery, and we do need to know which are which. So the second factor is, in Pali, it's vichara, and what it means is the receptive aspect of attention. So to be receptive is to be open, it's to receive all that occurs with unconditional friendliness. So it's just to receive. We're not saying, yes, I'll have that, thank you, but not that. It's to be open and receptive. And we need to be rather sensitive about that. A lot of our life is spent being caught up in doing, acquiring, or running after something, or avoiding something. And the Buddha asks us to sustain our attention on something by being receptive. So this is the practice. We remember that we're meant to be meditating, and then we're receptive about what's actually happening. And this receptivity helps the attention from darting off all over the place and sliding off somewhere else. Third factor is joy, actually the Pali is pitti, and another way of describing it is just fullness of being. So we can have a sense of just being. You know the sense when all of the busyness of the day falls away, all of the problems fall away, and there's that beautiful relaxation that somebody described in one of the groups this morning of just being. And when this happens, we see and understand that the root of joy is within the heart. And along with this experience often comes a sense of spaciousness as well. And the fourth of the factors is sukha, or ease. So ease, being at ease, being very relaxed, is actually one of the factors of awakening. It helps to wake us up. So it's important to remember. And it's a deepening of the joy. It's a great refinement of the attention once we really settle into our practice. And sometimes in this way we feel connected to all that's around. We get a sense of that which is greater than us. We get a sense of that which is beyond the body, or vast or immeasurable. And the key to accessing some of these quite deep states that we can access is equanimity, or steadiness. If we are steady in the face of the pleasant or unpleasant, our meditation practice will naturally deepen. And it will deepen until we have some some, possibly anyway, some rather profound experiences of the unification of the heart and mind. And sometimes we just touch in to an extraordinary experience of a heart that's wide open, or a heart that's let go everywhere. So one of the things we do is we train our mind to turn from the world of doing, having and gaining, from the world of form, to some of the other aspects of this life, some of the formless aspects that really help us. And one of these great formless aspects is love itself. And this is why it's so important that we practice with kindness, with care, with compassion, with goodwill, not only to ourselves, but others. This is a great key to discovering enormous depth of freedom. And love, of course, is the antidote to hatred and anger and ill will. Our practice always also has the power to transform and to heal. And yesterday, Jonathan referred to a monk who was ill. And his teacher came and sat beside him and apologized and said, "I'm really sorry. I've always wanted you to get well and I've put some pressure on you. And I give you permission to die." And this former monk is actually a friend of mine. And I want to read you what he said about this particular experience that was referred to yesterday in the talk, because I think it's really, really powerful and important. So he was really ill when he was in Thailand practicing as a monk. He had typhoid. He'd been a champion wrestler, believe it or not. So he'd been very big and strong. And I only met him last year, but he's now quite frail and thin as a result of the illness. And so, of course, he'd been unable to fully participate in life as a monk, and he was utterly convinced that he was a failure. So this is the sense of I, the I thought, lands, the sense of me lands in the world of thinking and says, "I'm a failure. I'm a failure because I can't get out of bed. I'm a failure because I'm so ill." And this is what he said about it. He said, "I stopped believing I had to get well. I began to receive my situation. As I lay in my bed, I would spend hours just being with the sensations in my body. I would hold the body in awareness and take attention with the breath right to the places where there was pain and just stay there with great patience and gentleness. Most important," he says, "my illness taught me how to die. In other words, how to surrender to what I couldn't change. I had to make peace with the confused states of body and mind that I encountered. My capacity for patience deepened, and in moments where I wasn't feeling sorry for myself or wishing my life were otherwise, I discovered a depth that is never sick, that never dies. My unyielding illness, which refused to follow my orders, took me to a place where I had lost everything I thought I was." I'll read it again. "I had lost everything I thought I was. Then I found what remains. I found that which no one can take away. This is a really profound understanding and experience. I lost everything I thought I was. So that's the cessation, the ending of all of his constructions of self. And with that cessation, he discovered that which remains, that which no one can take away. And this, that very teaching, is the deathless teaching of the Buddha. So we can touch and know this luminous quality of the heart and our mind for ourselves. It's accessible. And we might only know it for a second, but the very fact that we've experienced it for a second tells us our freedom is accessible. Each year in Bodh Gaya at the Thai monastery, I teach a retreat, a little plug for my retreat. And last year, a woman came. She had been to a retreat many years ago with Christopher at the monastery. And when she was there, she'd had some rather extraordinary experiences. But much later in her life, 20 years or so later, she found herself in a really difficult situation where she suffered from a very painful facial neuralgia. And she couldn't find any relief. She'd been to all kinds of doctors, allopathic doctors and alternative therapies, looking for some kind of cure. She'd been diagnosed with a very rare illness and there was nothing that could be done, she was told, except for a surgical procedure with an 80% failure rate. So she thought, well, maybe there's something else I can do. So she consulted Dr. Google and found that at the Thai monastery in Bodh Gaya, where she'd been 20 years before, I was teaching a retreat. And so she thought, I had a great experience there once, so maybe if I go back, something will happen, something will shift and change in my life. So she got on a plane, and within 4 days, there she was in Bodh Gaya sitting. Wonderful. Well, actually, she couldn't sit. She could only lie down. Now, in the temple, years before, she'd had a night where she actually asked the guard to lock her in the temple. In the old days in Bodh Gaya, you could do things like that. You could say, oh, I want to spend the night in the temple, and they'd let you be and leave you in there until the morning. And she said, during that night, what she saw was the Buddha image there vibrating. And this vibration was intense. And she said it came with a dissolution of the form. So what she saw, it's called an experience of signlessness. And the image vibrates and then completely disappeared. And so she had this experience, and then what followed was incredible sensations of love. And she didn't understand the experience, but she just knew that somehow it was valuable. So she came back. And so throughout the day, she really tried to practice diligently to be with her body. and she was in enormous pain. And so what I suggested was that she take her attention to any moments where the pain was absent. And so she said, okay, I'll do that. It isn't actually present 24 hours a day, so I'll note and notice whenever I don't feel pain. So she did. And then she came and reported in an interview. And of course, after trying many things, she was quite disillusioned about any possibility of being healed or being free from pain. And so she knew that I'd broken my leg. In fact, I had two broken legs. And I was on crutches for a year and a half. And so she said to me, well, how did you cope? What was that like? And I said, well, it is possible to have a broken body or a great difficulty in the body, yet it not to a great degree colour and shape the mind and bring great misery. Because even though I was in great discomfort, it wasn't that I was getting angry about it or upset about it. Certainly I needed some treatment, but to a large extent, it wasn't the major factor of my day. It was inconvenient, but it didn't colour the whole of consciousness. And so when I told her this, she, I guess, had a hope that there was a possibility of a shift in her circumstances. And she said as she walked away, she experienced incredible joy that just flooded through her whole body. And then instead of coming to the meditation where we were all sitting, she went again to the temple. And again, she had the experience of looking at the Buddha and the Buddha image disappearing before her eyes. And then came a memory of a childhood incident of being slapped across the face really hard by a nun when she was about 7 years old. The slap had been so hard that she'd fallen to the ground. And of course she felt incredible shame. But as she remembered the event, as the memories came back to her, her heart was filled with incredible love and compassion and understanding for the nun who had slapped her. Because she said the nun was just a young girl with a whole class of children and she didn't really know what to do with them. And so she said she had wave after wave of compassion and understanding and forgiveness. And then, guess what? The pain subsided. And she had, for the first time, 4 or 5 hours pain-free. And then, of course, she dared not hope that this continued. But it did. And this year she sent me a message. She said, please tell Radha, I am still pain-free. This is the power of the practice, to transform and heal. Now, I'm not saying that all illnesses have a psychological base. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that sometimes there can be a holding to something that without us even realizing. And this practice of taking the attention inward, being with our experience, noticing our freedom, actually, noticing the absence of pain, has extraordinary power. So what I asked her to do, Lucy, was to incline her mind to the freedom, incline her mind to the absence of the pain, rather than the habitual habit of mind which is to grasp and cling onto the uncomfortable sensations which we call pain. And this followed through her practice and dedication. What followed was this beautiful unfolding experience and a great release. So let that inspire you to practice. So to come back to my poem, gone to the beyond of becoming, you let go of in front, you let go of behind, let go of between. So we let go of all that we project into the future. We let go of everything that we have experienced in the past. And we let go of all that is in between. With a heart everywhere let go. You don't come again to birth and aging. So what this means, of course, is when we feel that extraordinary release, we don't come again to birth. The self is not born. We touch into that which is not bound to time. It's not caught up in the future. It's not caught up in the past. It's not anywhere in between. It's not even caught up in the present. And when we touch into that timeless truth, we are free from birth and aging. This is the profound teaching of the Buddha Dhamma, and it can be seen in our very life. It can be seen directly, here and now. Let's just sit quietly together for 2 or 3 minutes. Heart everywhere let go is the heart of freedom. Love liberates, and love is the expression of the liberated heart. May all beings live with love. May all beings realize the beyond of becoming. And may all beings live with a heart everywhere let go. thank you very much for listening. It's now time for walking meditation. With a heart everywhere let go.
התבקשתי להודיע שמי שרוצה להשתתף בקבלת שבת, היא הוקדמה בחמש דקות, זאת אומרת, שש ועשרה, במקום שש ורבע, באולם 11 כאמור.